Hello, welcome to another episode of Turkey Book Talk. I'm the host, William Armstrong. In this podcast, I talk to authors about newly released books on Turkey and its neighbourhood, which I've reviewed in the Hurriyet Daily News. You can subscribe to Turkey Book Talk on iTunes, Podbean or Stitcher, or you can follow via the Facebook page, or subscribe at my website, armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com. If you do enjoy listening to this podcast and you want to support it and me, you can do so via my Patreon account, making a monetary donation, small or large, on a per episode basis. Find details on how to do that through all the Turkey Book Talk pages. But now let's get on with the latest show. And for this episode of Turkey Book Talk, I welcome Michael Wuthrich from the University of Kansas. He's the author of a brilliant new book, which I really can't recommend enough. It's called National Elections in Turkey: People, Politics, and the Party System. And although that sounds like a rather dull and nondescript title, the book is actually full of fascinating details and makes an original and provocative argument. Wuthrich explores the motivations of voters in elections going back to the Turkish Republic's first free general election in 1950. Through close analysis of electoral and campaign data, he comes to the conclusion that ideological and national issues have typically been of secondary importance for Turkish voters, who generally prioritise their immediate material concerns. He also challenges the popular idea that politics in Turkey has always been defined by an unchanging cultural and social divide between a centre and a periphery, or between a secular-minded elite and economically marginalised religious masses. He shows that the empirical data paints a far richer and far more complicated picture. I started by asking Michael Wuthrich to give a brief overview of the case he makes in his book.
Well, the book is intended to respond to several different existing approaches to elections in Turkey. And one major approach was to kind of assume that the Turkish electorate or the Turkish voters were a bit static in their voting, and that they voted basically according to social cleavages, their identity, their political identities, and they tended, you know, to hold to that regardless of actually what was happening. And then the other arguments or the other approaches to studying the elections were to pay attention to just the campaign speeches or the campaigning, or to focus on the very micro details of each election. And I wanted to make an argument that, yes, there were patterns of how people voted in Turkey over time, but that those patterns were changeable and were strongly related to how the political parties themselves were trying to woo, to capture, to mobilize the voters in Turkey. And that as those strategies morphed and changed over time, as conditions changed, so did voting outcomes. So my book first addresses the maybe older and existing arguments and why those don't really show us a very useful picture in terms of understanding Turkish voting patterns over time. And so I lay out, especially starting in chapter 5, what I see to be some important voting patterns and voting consequences based on the different strategies that parties used to actually get voters to vote for them.
And you talk about how Turkish voters have generally been motivated by practical considerations over sort of national or ideological concerns. Could you just explain through some concrete examples of this through the 1950s, 60s, 70s, right, and beyond?
Yeah, certainly. Well, I think the pragmatic, very materialistic understanding of elections and voting and has been ingrained in Turkish politics since the 1950s, especially because of the Democrat Party. When the Democrat Party was running as the opposition party in the 1950s, they actually didn't, especially not on a national scale or in their campaign speeches, they weren't really trying to woo voters by identity or religion or ideology. none of that until maybe their last election in 1957. You see it cropping up because they knew that they were losing voters. What they were doing from the very beginning was basically trying to make very pragmatic appeals to voters and to communities, and they were doing a lot of work on the ground, things that weren't, that didn't show up in campaign speeches. I think a lot of the voters in the 1950s had little knowledge of what was actually being spoken in the official campaigns by the two major parties. What really seemed to generate the outcomes that we saw on Election Day were the kinds of patronage and clientelism and the canvassing that the party members did to various towns and villages in order to get people to vote for the party for very practical reasons. Parties rarely use just one strategy, of course, but that was one, that very pragmatic sense of trying to use policy or patron-client relations or very pragmatic policy promises to get voters to vote for them has continued really up to the present, although some other things have changed over time. I think that was, you know, even in the 2011 election, even when there was a relatively high amount of ideological or identity polarization, the parties themselves, if people were actually listening to them and paying attention to them, were often really trying to woo the pocketbooks of voters. And so even whether it was the Nationalist Action Party, MEHP, or whether it was JHP or the AOC Party or AKP, even to a large extent the BDP at the time, or the pro-Kurdish leftist party, were using largely, although they had other elements of their platform, they were using really economic, basic policy, pocketbook appeals to get voters to pay attention to their party.
And you mentioned the Democrat Party there in the 1950s, the Democrat mm-hmm. Party led by Adnan Menderes. And
right.
Of course, people now very often in Turkey look back and see that as the first instance of the periphery
right.
kind of fighting back against the state centralized, you know, Republican elites. And, you know, they see it as the precursor, really, of all the later right center-right parties up to
right.
up to political Islam in the 1980s and beyond. And one of the things that you point out in the book, which is really fascinating that not many people will know, is the way that if you look at the electoral map of results during the 1950s,
yeah.
the Democrat Party had its stronghold on the western coastal region, which is today
yes.
the stronghold of you know, the so-called secularist stronghold of
right.
the CHP, and the CHP had its stronghold in the southeast,
right.
which would also surprise people. So, I mean, what explains that dichotomy at the time?
Well, some of it had to do with different campaign strategies, and I mentioned this in the book. But the CHP, when it was the single party government, had two strategies of interacting with the people, especially going from the 1930s forward. One strategy was to, you know, especially in areas that were very distant from Ankara, you know, the remote villages in the east and et cetera, those areas were fairly decentralized. They weren't strongly connected into the center, and they weren't strongly tied into national society. And so what the CHP did at those times was develop basically relations with local notables, people that basically were kind of the local political elites, socio-political elites of the area. They developed relationships with them and then simply made them the liaison for that area, because they knew they wouldn't necessarily have great direct access communication with the people in the very remote provinces. They worked through the local notables and had connected them into the center rather than the people in general. And then the other strategy in the more developed areas, in the more central areas of the country, and as you move to the west, they actually, even during the CHP single party period, sent political elites out to the local populace to talk to them and hear their grievances and sit down in the, you know, the cabejones and find out what it is that they wanted, what their grievances were. And what's interesting is when the party system became a multi-party system, and the Democrat Party, which were really founded by CHP political elites, they weren't any different than the other elites in the that remained in the CHP. Those politicians actually adopted more of the approach of going out and talking to the people and finding out what they wanted and trying to build promises and relations in that way, whereas the CHP mostly relied on their strong relations at the time with local notables. And so you see in the first elections a consequence that's kind of paradoxical. So the CHP was able to get a lot of votes from the least developed, least centralized, most peripheral areas of the country, whereas the Democrat Party, because of its approach to campaigning, was far more effective in the more developed urban and rural communities. I mean, that's kind of the center periphery. I mean, both parties were staffed with elites that would have been considered part of the center. And so they were actually, both parties were campaigning in spite of the fact that they were central elites. They were trying to, both parties were trying to woo the periphery, and they did it in different ways. And so the Democrat Party was able to initially woo the more developed, quote unquote, or the more centralized, the periphery that was closer to the center, whereas the CHP was able to hold on to the periphery that was the furthest from the center based on their campaign strategies. And then, of course, because it was based on this patronage, clientelism, these agreements, you know, if you vote for us, we will provide this. When the Democrat Party had success in its first 4 years in office, that's success obviously built on what they were able to do in the subsequent election until the economy ultimately started tanking later in the 50s. And then they couldn't keep their promises and, of course, lost a lot of votes from 54 to 57.
And moving forward, you can see a similar pattern through the 1960s and 70s. And particularly interesting was the 70s, I think, because that was kind of the almost the high watermark of the Jair Pérez success under Bülent Ecevit. And again, what they were doing was wooing poor urban voters mostly through these, as you mentioned before, you know, pocketbook issues, kind of bread and butter concerns.
Yes, Ecevit actually was really ingenious in his ability to recognize where votes could be mobilized. And, you know, during the course of the 1950s and 60s, when the rural voters began going from the, you know, the periphery into the urban centers, often they were coming into the cities. And initially, it was the Democrat Party and the legacy party that followed them, the Justice Party or the Adalet Partisi, that was really working in the squatter areas, the poor urban areas. And Ecevit realized that the CHP, based on its ideological position, but also because it was a new area, that this was an opportunity that the CHP could really, the JHP could move into and be successful in. And so he crafted his political identity in order to really cater to these types of poor urban voters. And also, I mean, he was aware of the growing strength of the trade unions, the labor unions that were growing rapidly in Turkey at the time. And so he really became a hero for both of those populations. And so what you see as a huge change from the 1950s and the early 1960s to the late 1960s and 1970s is a huge switch in the fortunes of the CHP, going from, you know, the far east and most peripheral areas to all of a sudden losing almost all of that vote and gaining big time in the urban centers and the industrial centers. They were big in Zonguldak, for example, and mining communities and places where there was a lot of labor, blue-collar labor, and where there were urban settlements, because they were making the same kind of pragmatic appeals and promises that the the Democrat Party had done before them, and it worked to their success at that time.
And then later on, after the 1980 coup, there was obviously a big crackdown of, you know, basically all legal parties at the time, and mm-hmm. trade unions and other groups that were doing that the CHP was interacting with, and a big vacuum really opened up to do the kind of work that the CHP was doing before mm-hmm. for new groups, new Islamist mm-hmm. groups on mm-hmm. the urban periphery. And that was really the foundation that these Islamist parties, the Refah Party or Welfare Party, built up through, you know, local municipalities in Istanbul particularly. And that was a real foundation of its support. So again, mm-hmm. even though you had these kind of very ostensibly very ideological parties, you know, political right. Islamists, their foundation was built on, you know, these very pragmatic concerns, you know, providing services to people in urban areas that needed it.
Yes, absolutely. In the late 1980s, the successor to the CHP or JHP was the CHP, the Social Democratic Populist Party. And they had a key opportunity in the late 1980s to actually govern the municipalities of basically all the major urban areas, and they absolutely failed. I mean, they had this opportunity for entrepreneurship or just even taking out the trash, and they really blew that opportunity to show people that they were really the party that was taking care of the little people, that really were concerned about governance. They showed the very opposite. And so the Refah Partisi, the Welfare Party, actually benefited from Necmettin Erbakan's previous approach that probably, although yes, it was always Islamist, had this kind of conservative social democrat appeal to it. He always had a populist appeal. And so being able to use that element as he took over, saw a huge opportunity in the urban centers and municipalities. There was an opportunity there for them that kind of made sense. He basically benefited from the failures of the other parties to do the basic things that we expect governments to do, local governments to do. And it's, I think, up to this point, the center left, what we call the center left today, has never really recovered from their poor performance in the late 1980s when they had an opportunity.
Now, this center periphery narrative, meta narrative that you critique throughout the book, was first proposed by the Turkish sociologist Sherif Mardin mm-hmm. in an article in 1973, and it's as you say, it's had this very pervasive influence on scholarship ever since. I mean, what mm-hmm. do you think? Why has that center periphery meta narrative been so seductive?
Well, part of it is that the idea of a center and a periphery seems experientially true. I mean, and this might be true in every society. If you sit back and kind of think about how things work, you kind of imagine that there are people really that are from elite circles that are calling the shots, and you know, that the vast majority of the people really have no say in matter of fact. And I think you can certainly feel that experientially in Turkey. I think the confusion, though, and Sherif Mardin's article is interesting. I mean, it actually spends most of its time on the Ottoman Empire, and that's exactly when and where you would expect the center periphery to be at its height. And I actually agree with him on that. I think the center periphery, in terms of explaining the Ottoman state versus the populace, makes complete sense. But I think all the theory that the very notion of a powerful center and a powerless periphery, that notion by all theorists is confounded, like as soon as democracy enters the picture, as soon as universal education enters the picture, the lines get blurred between what is really the center and what is really the periphery. And I think that what has happened over time, one of the reasons why it's persisted is because you know, at a certain critical time there, at the when Sharif Mardin first wrote, kind of espoused that article, and he does touch on the current, you know, the multi-party system toward the end of the article. It wasn't really picked up and latched onto until the 1980s. But then in the 1980s, I think scholars started to see an east-west divide that looked kind of like, you know, the left was west and developed, and thus, you know, maybe the center, the power, and the east was the periphery. But the problem with that, and of course, a lot of the studies that have actually tried to trace the actual center and periphery, especially in elections or in party affiliation, have found it a little bit to be a holy grail. You know, it seems more real in legend and in one's mind than one actually finds in the data or in the empirical evidence. And so what has happened over time is that people look at the divide today and they just call it center periphery. But are we talking about an absolutely powerful versus powerless group? Is that the right way to describe the political cleavage today? I don't think so. And it's certainly not the same cleavage that we would have been talking about 20 years ago or 40 years ago. The voters and where those voters are coming from who support the various parties that we lump into the center and periphery have changed in important ways. And that's why I see it being so problematic. In research today that talks about the center periphery, they're usually calling the center periphery a religious versus non-religious political divide, right? So if for voters and their party affiliation, if they tend to be less practicing, less religious, they refer to them as the center. If they're more religious, they refer to them as the periphery. But this is also really problematic because, as most people know, if you look at all Western democracies and most of democracies, you have a right and a left, and you typically have, you're able to easily find correlations between the, you know, the right or the conservatives and more religious practice versus leftists and progressives or whatever who tend to have less religious practice. And so to call something like that a center and periphery, especially when we can't really even trace it economically or in any of the other indicators, becomes misleading and misconstrues what's actually going on.
I suppose one irony that I thought is that this idea of the center and the periphery is kind of subscribed to by both secularists and Islamists in Turkey today. You know, almost subconsciously, both sides find it shaping the way they think about politics.
Right. I think that's why I see it as a meta narrative. It's actually a convenient polemic for both sides. Like both sides have used it to explain their various fortunes or failures. And so a lot of secularists will talk about the center periphery divide as a way to really separate themselves from the others, or just say, you know, people don't vote for the center left parties because they don't have the education or enlightenment, you know, that the rest of us have, or a lot of the conservatives who like to represent themselves as the periphery are trying to really play off of the martyr imagery of the periphery, you know, the powerless people that have been marginalized or oppressed or stomped down. And so they use the periphery image to get advocacy, I think, for their cause. And what they're really underrepresenting it on their side is how strong they've been, how much say that the center-right parties especially, and conservatives, they've had a major say in Turkish politics and democracy really since the 1950s. They've rarely not had control of the premiership of the country in terms of the prime minister. And the secularists, when they use it, they often use it as a scapegoat. I think it keeps them from analyzing why they're really not resonating with a lot of voters in Turkey, why those political parties take kind of a tutelary attitude toward their own people that it seems to be derogatory or diminutive. So I think both sides use it, ironically. I've noticed the same observation that you have, that both sides use it, and they're using it as a narrative. But at the same time, it's really just keeping them from both sides from understand both sides of the current political divide. And there is one. There is certainly a current political divide, but it's keeping people from understanding each other and understanding the political motives behind the decisions that both sides are making.
Now, as you write in the book, today the situation's rather different. The AKP initially rose based on this idea of, you know, competence and pragmatic, practical delivery of services on that kind of Refa party lineage. But today it has turned to this kind of extremely ideological polar. I mean, that rhetoric's still there about service and, you know, getting stuff done. But it's also really heavily indulged in recent years in this extremely ideological kind of stigmatizing, polarizing rhetoric and motivating its supporters in that way. So, I mean, do you think we've reached kind of a critical threshold now? Or?
Yeah, I definitely think. And that's why, you know, my last chapter is a big question mark about whether the paradigm or the pattern that I saw starting in the mid-1990s, if it was in fact changing, because it, you know, during the mid to late 1990s and even through, you know, 2002 and 2007, it was the parties of the right that tended to be least ideological in their campaigning, a lot more pragmatic, and it was actually the parties on the center left that were really making their campaign, basing their campaign on the cultural struggle and us versus them, a light versus dark kind of appeal. One of the things that I noticed starting in 2011 was then those polls shifted with the rise of Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu in the CHP, and then actually I think the contraction of the party system to a smaller number of parties with a lot less leeway made the AKP change a little bit its strategy to cater more in its campaigning to shore up the base. You know, and this is true in about any democracy, that there's really a benefit to political parties in trying to increase polarization, to increase a divide, so that you don't have any voter attrition between blocks. So you raise the stakes to try to keep voters from leaving your side. And so there's definitely been a change there, and you know. So many things, the media, which is another thing that I address in the last chapter, the media changes the ability for the Justice and Development Party, both directly and indirectly, to influence media coverage. Really, so much of modern electoral campaigning, not just in Turkey, but anywhere, is based on both conventional and social media, that if you control that, it's almost... it's really not a fair election anymore. We're not talking about a completely free and fair election when governments have the dominant government party has media control. And so that has also created big changes, not just in the rhetoric, but probably even in the fairness of the campaign. And, you know, my frustration more has been in recent years after I published my book, you know, is when I spend so much time talking about the dynamics of democratic multi-party elections, I wonder, you know, does the book become a historical relic of what once was in Turkey, or will we continue to build off of electoral election dynamics in the future? And I think there are a lot of people that are worried or are posing that very question. And so that I think that's been an interesting development that, you know, maybe I didn't want to anticipate, perhaps, that we wouldn't be able to talk about electoral dynamics in the same way that we did from 1950 to 2011, and perhaps 2015. I think that could be up for debate.
Yeah, I suppose one way of looking at it is that there's never been a party that's as dominant as the AKP has been. There's never been a politician really that's been as dominant as Erdogan, and you know, when they've been in power for so long, you know, they've also got this access to state largesse, and you know, as you're mentioning, the media question is so important, and you know, I suppose on all levels, they've just got complete dominance and mastery that you do have to start questioning, you know, whether these electoral dynamics can even be analyzed anymore in this
in the same way.
In the same way, yeah.
And I, you know, with the all the components of the trouble the Turkish democracy is experiencing now were in the system at least from the 1980s. It was just those problems stayed under the surface because of the fragmentation of the party system. And I think once you had any party able to dominate for a period of time, then these other features come to the surface as real problems. When you have, you know, these major corporate holding media holdings that also have other businesses that really need government bids to survive, I mean, it takes away any semblance of independence, I think, in the media, even for the media that's technically, you know, independent or autonomous. They end up self-censoring because too much is at stake for their, you know, economic interests. And when power was fragmented, the independence actually worked out because there wasn't one player that everybody had to cater to, and that the rotation of power was such that, you know, they couldn't put all their marbles into the same, you know, one bag. But now certainly that's been the case where you have a dominant government since 2002, and that's radically altered the landscape. And so, you know, recent events and both regional and domestic instability just creates the opportunity for any dominant party to take advantage of this opportunity to enhance their own hold on power, to stay, you know, to ensure that the way that security and governance is set up will, you know, allows them to continue in office. And I think that's less ideological than just the nature of what happens with a dominant party where there's not a whole lot, where there's not strong enough checks and balances.
That was Michael Wuthrich. There's a link to my review of his book, National Elections in Turkey, People, Politics and the Party System, over at my website armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com. Remember, you can subscribe to Turkey Book Talk via iTunes, Podbean or Stitcher. If you enjoy the podcast, don't forget to rate it on iTunes or Stitcher, or like the Facebook page, which helps other people find the show. Also, remember that you can support the podcast via my Patreon account, donating on a per-episode basis. Many thanks to current supporters Andrew Cruikshank, Özlem Bey Arslan, Steve Bryant, and Aaron Ataman. But for now, until the next episode, thank you very much for listening.